Welcome to Changeling Cast, the podcast dedicated to reading and dissecting urban fantasy, paranormal, and speculative romance series. I'm your host, Mara, from the YouTube channel Books Like Woe, and this season we are making our way through Nalini Singh's Psy Changeling series. Today I'm pleasantly surprised to report that I liked Allegiance of Honor a lot more than I remember liking it the first time around. And I think this is actually a great lesson in how context really matters when it comes to how and when we read books. Because when I first read the Psy-Changeling trilogy, not trilogy, sorry, when I first read the Psy-Changeling series, I blazed through the first season because Shards of Hope was the most recent book out when I did my initial read. So I got to just fly through that first season. Then it was one of my favorite book binging projects I'd ever done. So I wanted to get a little bit of that thrill again, slash, you know, a little bit of procrastination. And so I ended up saving up basically three books to read before I kind of like came back into the series. So I read Allegiance of Honor, Silver Silence, and Ocean Light relatively close together, but definitely like, well, I guess 3 years it would be after that initial reading project that I did to read the first season. And so when I came back to the series, having Allegiance of Honor be the book I came back to it with really, I think, took some wind out of my sails for my enthusiasm for the series, because it really is that like transitional book that is wrapping up a lot of things that were happening in the first season, as well as setting groundwork for like what's going to happen in the coming season. So like now, having read it back to back with Shards of Hope and like being able to go straight into Silver Silence next, I actually think I appreciate the book a lot more this time around. I wonder also if just because like I know some of the things that are going to happen, so I know more what some of the things that it's setting up. So anyway, I definitely liked this book much more this time around than I did in my initial read, which was just a pleasant surprise. So I maintain the critique that I've always had of this book, which is that it is in a lot of ways like what I call a hangout book. And then that's a book in a series where really the main purpose of it is like time with your faves. So just, you know, cozy, hang out with all of these characters that we know and love, which is not a bad thing, but it does, I think, take momentum out of the book as a work unto itself. And I think that that is still here. I almost wonder if she had published this as like, rather than one continuous book, as I think I put this even in my review at the time, if she had published it as, let's call it 7 or 8 novellas collected into one volume with each of the storylines kind of going straight through. I almost wonder, and like, you know, you could have like allusions to what's happening in the other novellas in each of them. I almost wonder if it would have had a little bit more like oomph to it in terms of sort of momentum to get through the book. I did find that there are parts of this book that lag because the reason I'm suggesting that as a potential fix, quote unquote, for the book, I mean, far be it for me to dictate to Nalini Singh, but like the reason I'm suggesting that that might have been for me a more successful path to go is because I think any of the individual storylines, I don't know that there is enough there. And so when it all comes together, it does feel a little baggy to me. But that being said, you get so many great moments in this, and I want to, well, I'm trying to think, when should we do this? Maybe we'll do this after my plot summary. I want to like pause and talk about the characters that have been set up so far in the series that I'm like, here are all the people you're putting on the table, to get a book at some point. And some of them, we may already have gotten a book for them or a story from them, and others we may not have. So, starting with a plot summary, I'm going to try to go through each of these sort of like from their start to end, rather than kind of trying to do the cut back and forth. So we get to go back to a lot of characters that we've known and loved in previous books. That's some of the fun of this one. And I would say that most dominantly, this feels like a Sasha and Lucas book. Like, if I had to pick a main couple, it's kind of them, which I think is satisfying because they are such an iconic, like, great couple in the series that it's nice to just check in with them 3.5 years later, which is what we get a check-in with the time that has elapsed so far in the series. And it is specified in this book that it has been 3.5 years of in-world time since Slave to Sensation. So we're checking back in with them. If you will remember, they had a daughter about a year ago within the timeline of the books, and Naya is their daughter, and she is turning one. She turns one in this book. The dominant storyline for Lucas and Sasha is that they are increasingly aware, with the kind of propagation of the Trinity Accord and the rise in prominence of these like new different macro forces, that Naya is actually kind of in a position of increased danger. And that is because she sort of represents what this new unified world will ultimately be about, which is a more intense intermingling of these different races and new powers, new kinds of beings coming into the world, because she is the only kind of known side changeling child. And there's increased focus on her, and the book sort of starts with there being whispers in the Cynet, like, speculating about her. Some of it's just straight-up curiosity, but some of it, you know, kind of is getting into the realm of, like, quote-unquote pure blood, etc. So they have this increased, you know, distress that they think somebody is potentially going to target Naya. And that is increased as the book goes on because the rat pack, who lives in San Francisco, gets word that there are mercenaries in town that are looking for Naya. And there, it ultimately culminates in an attempted abduction of her and Sasha. Sasha is basically forced in that to use her Isai capabilities to essentially traumatize, emotionally, like, scar and attack the people who are trying to you know, get them. And so, you know, she has sort of this moment of having to reckon with that part of her power, but they're able to thwart that attempted kidnapping. From there, they discovered that the Consortium, which, if you'll recall, is the new baddie organization that started forming in the last couple of books. This is a consortium attack, and we also see that the consortium has used a changeling pack to do this. And that's, it feels kind of, I don't know. I think if the series has a quote-unquote good race, it tends to be the changelings because they are just so familially oriented. Also, okay, let's get there in a second. Because I also think that maybe this is a communist ideal. But let's get there. So they tend to be the least, they have the fewest baddies in the series as a whole. Like, there are bad apples, but it's always portrayed as a pretty much like an aberration. Humans are more likely to have, like, what I would describe as just sort of, like, weak bad characters, who are fearful or envious of the other two races. And then the Psi are the most likely to have these sort of, like, mustache twirling villains amongst them. So when we get changeling bad guys, it is sort of jarring. And what we find out is that there was a pack called, I think, Elk Sky, who were basically decimated during the period that we saw documented in books 12, 13, and 14, I guess, where there were people going mad, where the Psi were going mad because the Psi net was disintegrating. And in one of those episodes, basically the Psi that lived nearby invaded their land and killed, of the 93 of them, they killed all but 7. And in this, the Alpha lives, but he's basically been driven mad because his wife, or his mate, and his cub were killed. So it's this changeling pack of Ocelots, which I also thought was just, like, fun. to have like ocelot shifters. So like they're big cats, and so, you know, Lucas definitely understands kind of like how their pack works, etc. And we get some interesting insight from Lucas in the course of them finding out about this, of like how packs are actually supposed to work, that if you don't have enough dominance to defend the submissives and the elders and children, you're supposed to either reach out to other packs and ask them if they have like extra dominance who can come like live with the pack for a few years, or you're supposed to dissolve and get absorbed into other packs, because like if you cannot protect those who are weakest in your, or like most helpless or vulnerable, then you can't, like it's not responsible for you to continue to be a pack. And basically what we find out is that this alpha had like long been kind of on this path of essentially selfishness, that he liked the power, he wanted to keep it, and like that put his pack in a precarious position, and like he's just been going further and further off the edge. And so he ends up using pack funds to like, well, the consortium approaches him and they use pack funds to put out this hit on Naya, and they were going to have her abducted and taken to Australia, where then in theory, well, not in theory, in practice, the thought was the consortium could control Lucas and or Sasha if she survived the attack, because they wouldn't do anything to put her in danger. So we find that out, and Lucas actually ends up executing that alpha because he has broken changeling law, and, you know, also just that's how things rumble. And those six pack members who are left end up coming to Dark River and getting absorbed. So they have like two young soldiers, they have an older healer who's like kind of ready to retire, but you know, Tamsin would basically support Tamsin in her role, like kind of providing a second layer of healer to the pack. And then there's also a submissive who's going to adopt the two children who are left. And we find out that the pack has all of this money, the pack that gets absorbed in, has all this money from patents that somebody in their group had created and had signed over to the pack. And I will say, it occurred to me while reading this book that we love the way that the changeling packs work so much, and they are actually kind of like a communist utopia, because when we, like, I'm going to pay more attention to this, but it is said many times throughout the series that there is this concept of like pack money, and the pack employing its members. Like it seems like there is independent money, but it also seems like a lot of it really is driven and like communally held, including land. I don't know, it's very interesting. I was thinking about this because I was watching I was watching a YouTube video the other day, and they were talking about how like people in the US often like to, well, here in the US we have very specific kind of shaping of our ideas about socialism and communism that is very driven by specific political agendas. Like, I neither good nor bad. That's true in any country, that like national narratives are shaping, you know, its population's perceptions of different things. But they were pointing out that we in the US have labeled a lot of countries as communists that are actually not communists, because true communism has never actually been achieved. All of those countries are socialist. And I was just reflecting on how, like, I don't know, ironic, interesting, et cetera, it is that people love the changeling pack so much in this series, and actually in paranormal series in general, but specifically in this series, these changeling packs are as close to being communist as I've ever seen described. Like, these are kind of like communist utopias. So I don't know, I just thought that was interesting to think about. So anyway, I forget how I got on that topic. I think I was, I think I was talking about the Ocelot tribe that comes in, or pack that comes in. They had $4 million in trust, and so there's like discussion about what is going to happen with that money. So that's the dominant part of Lucas and Sasha's storyline. The other thing that happens is they also come to the decision that they want Naya and Nikita to meet, because they decide that if Nikita is kept from Naya, eventually, just like, because, you know, cats in particular are known for being very curious, but also just because like teenagers are curious, Naya might go seeking out Nikita later on in her life if she's sort of like kept as a secret from her, sort of a thing. And they also decide that Nikita will be like a fierce defender of Naya if she becomes as invested in her as she was in Sasha. So they kind of come to that conclusion, and they spend a lot of the book sort of dancing around making that happen. Part of why they want to do it now is because Nikita is still healing from the attempted assassination, and so she's sort of got her... she's not as, like, walls up as she typically would be. So they arrange to meet her secretly. They kind of just show up. They have Vasek teleport them in. And we get to see Nikita meeting Naya, and we get to learn more about... I think we just get more shades and nuancing around Nikita's decision to keep Sasha, despite apparently a good deal of pressure to either abort or kind of just put her in an institution from birth because she was an E. There was that layer of kind of understanding more about where Nikita was coming from, but also just like Nikita's, we get some POV from Nikita and really see, I don't know, even just from my conversation with Nalini and her talking about Sai parenting, I think I have a lot more warmth towards Nikita this time around in my reread, just because I think she is a very logical example of a Sai parent who actually intensely loves her child, but has no, like, language to experience that. She's had no socialization to experience what that emotion is, and she's in a society where she cannot express that in any way that we would describe as, like, correct parenting or, like, loving parenting. So I think I just have a lot more compassion for her this time around, and I also think it's interesting just to see her, like, giving Sasha tips about how to train Naya, because she basically points out, like, hey, you've not taught Naya that there are, that she can't just be completely loving and open with everyone she meets. There are actively people who want to do her harm. Like, you need to teach her boundaries. And I think Sasha has this nice moment of realizing, like, yeah, that's true. Like, I've swung too far in the other direction of, like, never wanting to put any restrictions on her or have her ever, you know, be afraid of someone from the outside. But that may have been going too far in the other direction. The other thing that comes up, and I'm going to say, I actually don't like this little nuancing or, like, retconning of the initial meeting of Sasha and Lucas. And that is, Sasha and Lucas suspect, and then Nikita confirms that she purposely put Sasha in the pathway of a changeling pack because she was hoping that she would be able to leave the Psynet that way. Because she knew she was, like, having a breakdown, and she knew from, like, historical records that changelings had been able to absorb Sai in the past into their whatever. So, I don't know. I think that's a little too much retconning for my personal taste. I didn't love that note. But anyway, so that's I would say if there was an A plot of this book, that would be it. We also get more from the Arrow Squad, who I love. You guys know that. So we see, you know, POVs from both Aiden and Vasek. I'm going to take it back. That is one of the A-plots. The other A-plot is that Black Sea has lost another member to the consortium. They've been abducted. And a lot of the book is spent with the Arrows in particular trying to help find this Black Sea pack member who is being tortured from what they can tell. So Vasek is particularly very involved with that, as is Zara, because Zara and Mian, I never know how to say her name, they definitely formed a bond in the last book of, you know, two very strong women who have a very similar kind of, like, personality and outlook on the world. So, and Zara was very involved in trying to find the last group of Black Sea members who were abducted, and so she's also involved in this one. So there's several sort of, like, clues that we get along the way as to where this changeling is being held, and we kind of have several, like, we got to the place too late moments where they find where the changeling, I think her name was Layla, where Layla was previously, but now she's gone. They get help in this from, so they have the Arrow Squad that's helping them do that. The other thing that they get help from is Tanique Gray, who is the half-brother of Faith Nightstar and the son of Anthony Kirakis. So that, I thought, was a nice layering. We basically get to see Faith and Vaughn again, which it's always nice to check in with them. We also get a conversation. We get several conversations about, like, where are we with kids kind of thing happening in this book. Judd and Brenna have a check-in where they agree that they want to have kids, but not right now. Vaughn and Faith also have that conversation. But anyway, they have, like, a check-in and say, like, we don't want to have kids because Faith is still getting these very, like, violent predictions or foresights, and she isn't totally confident that she would be able to, like, if she was alone with their baby and she got one of those, she doesn't feel like she's in control of that enough yet to feel comfortable having a kid. But anyway, so Faith's brother Tanique, we get to see them, like, making this connection, and, like, he's 24, but he is, like, moved over from his maternal family line into the Nightstar clan. And we learn a little bit about, like, if that happens before someone's 30, you have to, like, pay a fine to the other line for, like, lost revenue. I thought that was an interesting, like, layering of the world building. But he came over because he is, like, wanting connection, and he knows that Anthony and the Nightstars can provide that to him. So we get this, like, he's just sort of this sweet, awkward guy who clearly, like, wants to break silence, but he's not quite sure how to do that yet. So just seeing him and, like, seeing him being wanting that connection with Faith, but not really knowing how to do it in his, like, cold, silent way was really sweet. So yeah, anyway, just something there. But he is a psychometric psi, which is where you can, like, touch an object and, like, see its history. So normally he works on museum stuff, but they bring him in a couple of times in the search for Layla because they find objects from her, and he's able to, like, give them some clues about what was going on when she was at that specific place. So they eventually do find Layla. She is still alive. And it's actually the Human Alliance who helps. Like, they see her, like, one of their members sees her being what he thinks is just, like, straight up trafficked. And so he intervenes, and eventually they do recover Layla. But we get to spend a lot of time with the Black Sea group because of that. So we have that whole plot line happening. Something else that happens with Vasek is that Zizen, his biological great-grandfather, but the man who is, like, functionally his dad, ends up passing away, and I cried. It was very sweet. It was very beautiful because, basically, I just thought it was a lovely, like, reflection on a life that has been lived with intention and with purpose, even when it comes to an end, like, is still a beautiful thing because, you know, we all live and we all die, and death is a part of what gives life meaning. And I don't know, it was really sweet to see Zizen honored, and, you know, that obviously impacts Ashaya and Kenan because, you know, they were very close with him. It impacts Vasek, obviously, like, there's this big tribute to him. So anyway, I just thought that that was really sweet. We get that. Another through line that happens is we're getting these interstitials from Father Xavier, who, if you, oop, my cat is inspecting the mic, so you may hear from him. If you'll remember, Father Xavier is friends and has been sort of, like, allied with Judd and with Caleb back when Caleb was still the ghost. And we knew that Father Xavier has gone to South America to try to find his, like, long-lost love, who was, he thought, killed during this attack from Psy, but turns out she wasn't. And so we're getting all these letters from him, like, over the years from when that attack happened. And it was actually really sweet because we get to see how he and Judd met, and that Judd was already, like, being, like, defecting and stuff. So we get to see some of how that came to be from Xavier's point of view. And we also get, you know, he ultimately is reunited with Nina, and she thought that he was dead, and they get married, and it's very sweet. And there's also this sweet connection with Caleb and Judd. And we don't get a ton from Caleb and Judd in this book, but we get, like, some, and just, I don't know, we get these moments of them being checked in with Sahara and with Brenna and just seeing that they're happy. There's this moment where apparently Caleb and Sahara, I think we've heard this before, they have like a wall that they're trying to fill with like pictures from their new life together. And he notices that she took this picture of him and Judd where it's very clear that they're like friends. And he's like reflecting on the fact that he has friends now. It's so sweet. I just love that so much. Something else that Caleb is involved in, and this also works in some of the macro plot stuff that is getting set up or is happening. And that is, for some reason, they still are finding like these disintegrating parts of the Psi-Net, and they don't know why. And they try to get the net mind and the dark mind to explain to them what's going on, but like it can't really. And so there's sort of this race to try to figure out like, okay, this Psi-Net is still dying in some way, but just like more slowly and in a different way, but like, why is it still dying? And what they eventually, by like doing some pattern finding, they discover that it's very healthy around Sophia Russo, who if you'll recall is a J-Psi who we met in book 8, and around, oh gosh, who else? It's around Clara Alvarez, who is the director of Haven, which is where Samuel Rain is, and he's the guy who like saved Vasek in book 13, and then around Stefan, who if you'll recall is in one of the early novellas that we encountered, and he's down on the substation Alaris, and I really liked his love story. But they discover that all three of them have these like peaceful, healthy sections around them, and the thing that unites all of them is that they are mated to humans. So I think this is actually a really interesting and important, so it's setting up things that need to happen in future books, because one thing they've realized is that like people in the Psi-Net have to get connected to humans or else the Psi-Net will die. And they've literally spent the last 100 years like isolating and making humans afraid of them. So how is that going to work? But I also think thematically, like that's a really beautiful like metaphor and is very aligned with overall kind of the message of the series, which is like the Psi-Net cannot be healthy if it is insular and cut off from connection, including connection to other races, not just connection, emotional connection to other Psi, but emotional connection and like unitedness with the totality of Earth's population. So I think thematically that makes a lot of sense, but also this is like another macro plot thread that, you know, there's going to be tension around. And then what else? I mean, gosh, there's so many like little plot lines. We get some things with Cooper and Grace because he's making a business deal with Pax Marshall, who's a Psi we met a little bit more in the last book and who will come up more and more over the next season. Hawk. Okay, yeah, this is a significant moment with Hawk and Sienna, where Hawk goes to have a meeting with Ming Laban without telling her, and she, like, it's a real big deal. But basically what he is trying to do is he's trying to, like, cut Ming Laban off from business stuff. So, like, he has basically now made it Snow Dancer and Dark River's mission to like screw over Ming Laban, and that's going to be their like new sneaky slow plan, is to just like screw him out of as many business deals as possible and really like cut off his power so that they can then kill him, because they know that he is like a huge stabilizing force in Europe right now, and if he died, possibly a lot of people would die. So they can't kill him right now, but if they like lessen his importance, then maybe they could. And also, Ming Laban tries to join the Trinity Accord. Oh, by the way, so he goes to a bunch of business meetings. Sienna gets mad at him. They make up, and basically this is like going to be a new strategy of Snow Dancer. But Ming Laban tries to join Trinity Accord, but is denied. He's really pissed about it. So then he tries to set up a European-only version of Trinity Accord and say like you could be a member of both, but like it's clear that that's not going to go very well. But it also does raise this kind of moment where Nathan from Dark River brings up to Lucas like, hey, we got to be kind of careful about who we're just like straight up excluding from this. That's a lot of power for us to wield, and like you're setting some potentially dangerous precedents here of like elbowing someone out. So like you need to be thoughtful about this. So there's this discussion that maybe what they're going to do is like have essentially, if there are people who want to join that people in the Accord are suspicious of, they can be given sort of like, basically like a junior status that's probationary for 5 years. And if they sort of like prove their good intent in that time, then they can like fully join. But I thought that was also a nice like nuancing of, okay, this is a new world. And Lucas in particular, I think in this book, we're seeing that he holds a lot more power than he's ever really wanted, but that he like ends up having. So yeah, I don't know. I thought that was a nice like layering to the book. So we get that. And then, oh goodness, what else? There's so much that happens in this book. There's so many side plots. I guess the last big side plot, or like the last big thread here, is that we are on the countdown with Riley and Mercy waiting for the pup cats to be born. And all of that is super sweet, super charming. And finally, Mercy does give birth to the pup cats who we've been waiting, or the pup cubs, sorry, I've been saying pup cats, pup cubs. The pup cubs are born, and there are two boys and a girl, and the two boys are wolves, and the little girl is a leopard. And they are like, oh, you know, that means Riley is the most dominant. And he's like, well, no, because the girl came out first. So in theory, that means that she's the most dominant. So, you know, kind of the takeaway from that is very much that we still really don't know who's, I mean, I think that we've figured out that Riley is slightly more dominant than Mercy, but it's sort of a wash. And it's also very sweet because both Hawk and Lucas really like see both of these, like all of the cubs as their own, all of the pups as their own, regardless of like what species they are. And so like they kind of say, you know, yes, ultimately, you know, the two wolves are under Hawks for discipline and ranking, and you know, the leopard is under Lucas for discipline and ranking within the pack, but like they both kind of belong to both of them. So it's just like a beautiful, I don't know, there's a lot of reflection in this book about how like how far the two of them have come and how cooperative they're able to be as two different alphas, and how really like this represents the fact that Snowdancer and Dark River are two independent parts of a greater whole, that like they really are two halves of a family. And the fact that Mercy and Riley are mated and then now literally have children, you know, is sort of the physical promise or the physical payoff of the fact that this is something that's evolved. And, you know, we know that Desi and, oh gosh, I forget his name, but the botanist guy, like they've gotten mated and they're going to have kids. So like increasingly we're going to see couples that are blending between these two packs, and these packs are likely going to just continue to be incredibly enmeshed. And the fact that these two leaders were able to achieve that with the support of their packs is like really notable and unique and just like special. As we know, this is from what we know about this world, it's very special. So because they knew that the babies were coming, they'd been planning this big like joint party. They have it on the training grounds where the Arrow kids are coming to have play dates with the changelings, if you will recall that. And there's discussion about like who all they're gonna invite, and like that they want to include, you know, some significant allies. So like, for instance, they invite Caleb and Sahara because Sahara is family to Dark River and Caleb has been a really important ally. And, you know, they invite the rat pack, and like that is a significant moment of the rats realizing that they are seen as like really important allies and like, you know, trusted friends, like they are trusted to come to this very important, you know, pack event. So it's very sweet, and I loved it. So, like, everything around the babies is very tender and very adorable, and I loved all of that. I'm just a big sap, so I love that. And it's appropriate because the midway point, Zizen dies, so we kind of have, like, a funeral in the middle of the book, and then at the end of the book, we have the celebration of new life. So it feels also very kind of, like, symmetrical for the book as a whole. Two significant things. Oh, I might cry talking about this, guys. I cried multiple times in this book because Nalini Singh was just like serving us like all of the tender moments. Like I cried when Zizen died. I cried several times in this book because they were such great character moments throughout this book that, like, if you've been reading the series, it was just a lot of, like, here you go. Like, here is this lovely moment for you. Enjoy. So two things that made me cry at the baby's celebration party. One is that Laura and Walker realize they're pregnant, and I love Walker so, so much that I just want good things for him. And he's so excited, and he's talking about how much, like, he regrets that when Marley was little, he couldn't give her everything he wanted to give her because it wasn't safe, and, like, he couldn't express emotion in, like, her sweet, tender baby moments that he wanted to, and that, you know, he worries that that's hurt her, and everyone's like, well, no, Marley is great, don't worry about that. But, like, he is so excited that he's gonna get to just be a dad and, like, be a dad fully the way he wants to. And, like, Jed is excited for him, and he's talking, like, he internally is thinking about how, like, he's the best father and best man he's ever known, and it just makes me cry. So Jed and Caleb are having sweet moments together at this party. But then Annie and Zach show up with their baby named Rowan, who it's been previously established doesn't have a middle name because Annie, I'm going to cry even talking about this, Annie wants to give Rowan the middle name of the TK boy who saved her from the train crash. And she's obviously seen Caleb around, but she's never been that close to him. And she finally is close enough to him that she sees his eyes and she realizes it was him. And, like, she goes up to him and it's just so sweet. Oh, I can't stand it. It's just, I can't. I love it so much. And so they're going to name the baby's name is Rowan Caleb Quinn. And, like, they basically say, like, you are now a part of our family. And Caleb doesn't really know what to do with that, but I do. I'm the reader, and I know what to do with it, and that's to cry. I'm crying right now. It's so beautiful. Anyway, so that was also very satisfying. So I think that now that I've, like, gotten all mushy and gooey in this, if you cannot tell, this is just filled with little moments that are incredibly exciting for readers of the series because it's, like, building on the world, nuancing different characters. You know, we have Kenan calls Dorian dad for the first time. I mean, there's a million little moments like that in this book. We get things with the Forgotten. We get to check it with Bowen. Oh, I didn't mention that. I should also mention this. This is another ticking time bomb that's coming up in the series. We find out that the implants that the Human Alliance has to block them from being able to have their mind read by Psy, the original models of them are failing and they're going to kill whoever has them. And that includes Bowen. So we have ticking time bomb there, FYI. But anyway, we have Bowen, we have, you know, the humans, we have the Forgotten, we have just everyone. We get almost everyone. Aiden and Remy have, like, a climbing adventure together over in the Appalachians. There's just so many moments in here. I can't even hit them all. But it's very satisfying if you are a lover and reader of the book. Now, I do want to give a rundown of characters who, and some of these, you know, some of these have had books already, but I'm just going to give you, like, a rundown of characters who at this point in the series, it's like, it seems like you're setting this character up to have a book. Okay, we've got the two, I think it's only two now, two lieutenants of Snowdancer who have not gotten any kind of story, and that is Alexei and Matthias. We have Mayan Levesque and Malachi from Black Sea. We have Bowen and his sister Lily from the Human Alliance. We have Pax Marshall, who is being characterized very similarly to Caleb, I feel like. So there's that. We have, we've met the Russian Pax before, but particularly Selinka, who is a wolf alpha who lives near Caleb. And I believe we've also heard from the bears of that region. So not a specific character, but we kind of get a sense that they're going to be in play. Silver Mercant, who works for Caleb. I also should mention that in this book, Caleb and the Mercants make a formal, he essentially gets formally, like, adopted by them. Like, they now consider him to be a member of the family. He has a meeting with Ina where that gets solidified. We also find out from the architect's POV in this that Ina has an alliance with the architect, but she doesn't know that the architect is the architect. So anyway, side note there. But Silver definitely is being set up. I feel like Tanique Gray gets some setup here in this book, that he would be a good future hero. We get Sage and, ooh, I forget the other brother of Mercy, but I think both of them. We have Jamie and Desi both got promoted to Sentinels in Dark River. So we have, Desi's already gotten her story, but Jamie, I feel like, is kind of set up. Kit and Rena, they are brother and sister of Dark River. We've seen them a lot over the course of the series. And Kit in this book officially goes off to Rome. So, you know, that's sort of really a sign of him fully coming of age. So, you know, he's getting set up. John is still young, but he's 16, I think, in this book. So, like, as the series progresses, you know, I think he's on the radar of someone who could get a story. I think those are most of the main ones I wanted to shout out that I was like, I know I'm going to kick myself here when I log off. I'm going to think of someone else. But I think that was everyone. I mean, there are a couple of other folks that I want to mention as we go. But I think of this. Oh, Remy. That's who I'm thinking of. Remy, I think, certainly needs a book. He's the alpha of the pack in the Smokies. Payal Rao, I guess, has also been brought up in this. And I do think is somewhat foreshadowed as potentially having a book. And then I guess the only other at this point that I want to mention is Nikita and Anthony. Because it's pretty overtly said in this book and has been said for the last few books that, like, clearly there's something there. And everyone's like, Anthony, you are brave. Like, Anthony, way to go, Anthony, going after Nikita. What I would like, I definitely would like to see, I don't think a full book with them, but I think a like novella with them would be great. And I would actually love to see it as like an asexual kind of romance, because I think that they would be a great example of, they're very entrenched in silence and they're older, and I don't know. I mean, I guess maybe I'm stereotyping that, like, it's impossible for them to have sexual attraction. That's probably not the case. But I don't know. I think this could be a good opportunity to have an ace romance, like, for them to be asexual but have romance. I don't know. I feel like that would be an interesting angle on them getting a story together. But, like, it is pretty clear that they are together. Like, they're meant to be together. So at some point, that would be really good to see. So I think those are people we've met or had alluded to at this point that I can bring up as, like, either confirmed future main characters of books or ones that I think are on, like, fans' wish list of stories we would like to see. So in terms of rating this book, well, for Cozy Community Vibes, I'm going to give it 10 out of 10 Pup Cub celebratory partying, because, like, all this book is Cozy Community Vibes. It's with all of the different communities that we've seen brought up over the course of the series so far, and, like, that is what this book excels at, is the overall community vibes. I'm gonna give this, like, a 4 out of 10 attempts to get it on but interrupted by the packs, because Judd and Brenna were having sexy times and then got interrupted by the rest of the pack. Yeah, this one is not, I would say, like, one of the sexier books. Like, there are sexy times in it, but I don't think that's, like, the dominant vibe of this particular one. In terms of political machinations, we'll give it, like, 6 out of 10 attempted abductions of Naya. There is, you know, some wrap-up political stuff happening. And, like I said, we do have, like, some things seeded that are going to be important for season 2. But I don't think that this is one of the, like, bigger books in terms of macro plotting. And then for angst, this is not an angsty book. I'm going to give it a 1 out of 10. Are we going to be able to save the Cynet from dying when they need to, like, humans? I don't know. Like, I guess that's the closest thing to an angst moment that we get in this one, but I don't think angst was, like, the dominant tone of this particular one. This was heavily weighted towards time that we love with our favorite characters. So with that, I think that that will wrap up Allegiance of Honor. Like I said, I ended up liking this one quite a bit more than I remembered. I remembered liking it okay, but this I actually, you know, did enjoy pretty well. So I would actually, I gave it 3 stars originally. I would give it 3.5 stars now. I do still think it has problems as like a book, like the structure of a book itself versus as a kind of like cog in the machine of a series, but I did enjoy this one a lot more this time around, just I think because I was in the right flow to appreciate it. So 3 out of 5 stars for this one, and welcome to 2022, by the way. We're back in the swing of things, and we will be charging along. Next time, in 2 weeks, we will be talking about the first book of season 2 of Side Changeling, which is referred to as Side Changeling Trinity. That is the sort of like sub-series of the series as a whole. And that is Silver Silence. And it is called Silver Silence because Silver Marcant is our heroine. So we have seen a lot from her over the course of the books. She has been growing in her importance in this. In Allegiance of Honor, we heard the architect talking about how his number one target, or their number one target to take someone out, is Anthony Caracas, and number two is Silver Marcant because of how important she is. So, if that gives you any sense of her importance to the overall story, we will be dealing with her story, and it is a much loved book in the series. I know people really love the hero in this one. I won't give that away, but anyway, that one is coming up in 2 weeks, and I'm excited to dive into season 2. I haven't reread any books in season 2, and I don't know. I'm going to be interested. There's some books in the second season that I think are some of the best in the series. There's others that I think are not some of the stronger ones. Well, I guess really one in particular I have in mind. But yeah, I think this will be interesting for me because I didn't binge these. I kind of, for the most part, read them as they were coming out. So I think I have a different sort of sense of what they're like. And I will be excited to see how I perceive them more in the flow of the series rather than as just sort of like new installments that I'm getting once a year. So anyway, we will talk about Silver Silence in 2 weeks, and I hope you have had a great start to your 2022. And if you want to hear more from me, you can follow me pretty much everywhere as at Books Like Whoa on Goodreads and YouTube and God, what, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, all the things. You can find me at Books Like Whoa. And I think that will do it. I will talk to you guys in 2 weeks. Bye!